Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
A war began for no wise purpose, carried on with a strange mixture of rashness and timidity, brought to a close after suffering and disaster, without much glory attached either to the government which directed or the great body of troops which waged it. Not one benefit, political or military, has been acquired with this war. Our eventual evacuation of the country resembled the retreat of an army defeated. That was not a newspaper report on this week's calamitous American evacuation of Kabul, but the report on an earlier Western engagement in Afghanistan, the First Anglo-Afghan War, and it was the words of the Reverend George Gleig, who wrote the first account of that war in 1843. And Dominic, some eerie parallels there, aren't there?
Yeah, it's hard to resist the parallels. So that's one of the most famous military disasters in British history. It's our first great encounter with Afghanistan. Some listeners will know it as the stuff of the very first Flashman book. That's how I first encountered it. And I think other listeners, Tom, may know the painting. I don't know if you know the painting. I bet you do, by Elizabeth Butler, called Remnants of an Army, where the last guy, the one survivor,
Dr. Brydon.
Dr. William Brydon, he's sort of on his horse or mule or whatever it is in the pass. And he's the only one left. You know, nearly 20,000 men have been, women and children have been killed.
And well, him and Flashman, of course.
What's the Flashman, of course?
Flashman is the other survivor.
But of course, this is the image of Afghanistan that is so current in the newspapers at the moment, the graveyard of empires. So the British tried and failed. Supposedly, this is the claim. The British tried and failed. The Soviet Union tried and failed. And now the United States has tried and failed as well.
Okay, well, I think there is really only one person to get on to talk to us about the first Afghan war. And that is Willie Dalrymple, who was an earlier guest talking about his book, The Anarchy on the East India Company, which in a way is a kind of the prequel to the events we're going to discuss today.
He comes with a slight health warning there, doesn't he, Tom? Because he is the holder of the Rest is History all-time record for speaking uninterrupted.
He is.
Without interventions from us, which I think he spoke for basically an hour. And we said hello and goodbye. And
So somebody commented on Twitter that he was like Fenton, the notorious dog that went chasing deer in Richmond Park. And there was the hapless man running after him shouting, Fenton, Fenton. And that's what we were like. So it's very exciting to have Willie back on the show. But Willie, before we kick off, that passage that I opened the podcast episode with, that's your author's note in the book that you've written about this, The Return of a King, which is part of the Company Quartet, this collection of four volumes about the East India Company in India, which is available now. So I hope I've paid my dues there. So Fenton.
You can shout at any point if you want me to stand to leash.
Okay, I'm going to throw you a stick here. The First Afghan War, how does it begin?
So, this is rather a long story. one evening in 1837, a man who you're, I'm sure, very familiar with, George Rawlinson, who's famous for translating the Behistun inscription, who's this Orientalist who'd been based in Persia as part of the East India Company mission to try and get cozy with Persia and to turn them against Russia, who were the East India Company's great rivals. And in the background to this is that over the previous 100 years, at the same time as the East India Company was expanding out of Calcutta to take over all of India and then marching towards the Himalayas. Same time as this is happening, in Russia, the Russians are moving south at a rate of 100 miles every decade. And by the 1840s, have reached what was called the Orenburg Line, which is just north of the great caravan cities of Khiva, Bukhara, Tashkent, which, as we know now, will fall to Russia in the 1880s and 1890s and in a later phase of the period. But at this point, in 1840, the The East India Company has now occupied all of India, South Sutlej. The Russians are at the Orenburg line, and everyone is eyeing the territory, the shrinking space in between these two expanding empires. And so what George Rawlinson sees one early dawn in 1837 is very important. He's riding from Behistun, where he's been literally in the middle of translating this inscription, been built a scaffold to take all the cuneiform down. And to,
so this is the inscription left by Darius the Great back in the late 6th century BC.
And this is the, kind of the Rosetta Stone of the Persian, because it also has Aramaic, and that allowed the translation to be made. And Rawlinson, who's literally been working on this the previous 6 months in all his spare time, has now been summoned back to work, so to speak, from this Orientalist sabbatical on the Behistun inscription, and is riding towards the Persian border city of Meshed, where the new Shah is about to try and invade the principality just over the border of his territory, which is Herat, previously a great center of Persianate culture for many centuries, but now independent of the Qajar kings of Persia. And there are Russian military advisors working with Persians and the East India Company, very unhappy about this. So Rawlinson's been sent off to observe the start of this campaign. And he's been riding from Western Persia because a war is breaking out. The normal post horse system isn't working in the caravanserai. And he can't get his mount exchanged. So he's exhausted, his horse is exhausted. And at some point, just as he's heading towards Meshed, he actually falls asleep in the saddle. It's a long time since I've ridden seriously, and I don't know how long, probably stay asleep in a saddle without falling off. But when the moment comes that he does sort of nearly slip off the saddle in his sleep and wakes up, he realizes that his horse has wandered off the road and he's lost in these very dangerous borderlands. Now, even today, this is a place where opium smugglers work the heroin trade between Iran and Afghanistan. It's a place that has always been what we call in Scotland debatable land. It's the border territory that you just do not want to get lost in at any time, particularly in a war, particularly at this moment. So Rawlinson is quite frightened, and he wanders around in the dark, not quite sure what to do. He's not on a road, doesn't know where he is. And then dawn breaks over the Koh-i Shah Jahan Mountains, and he begins to orient himself. You can see a valley, and he's heading towards it when he sees a cloud of dust coming towards him. And he knows what there's clearly a large body of men heading towards him on horseback. So he does what any of us would do in this situation. He dismounts, he ties up his horse in a little overhang of rock and goes belly down to see what's coming.
So it's kind of like we have the Wild West. This is the Wild East.
This is the Wild East. And of course, because this, you know, has to be a movie at some point, Rawlinson is, as well as a prize-winning Persianate Orientalist, he's also a secret service agent working for British intelligence, inevitably speaking. And he's in touch with the British spymaster Claude Wade, who's based on the Afghan border, and also Pottinger, who's based in Gujarat. These are the two East India Company spymasters collating information in Central Asia and Afghanistan, with the whole ring of spies, of carpet sellers, and so on, working.
The Great Game.
The Great Game. This is the very, this in a sense is where it begins. This is almost the moment it begins. There's a few spy networks, but there's actually been no action until this moment. And Rawlinson looks up and he sees these horsemen resolve in front of his eyes into the thing that every East India Company intelligence officer had been predicting, but has never had any evidence for. It is a party of Cossacks in full uniform with a Russian flag flying, heading over the border from Persia into Afghanistan, and there's a considerable number of them. And Rawlinson then follows them rather bravely, and having sort of shadowed them less successfully than he realizes, he actually stumbles across them, making a samovar of tea in a gully somewhere, just as dawn is coming up. And in charge is a multilingual, his direct parallel, on the Russian side, who is a man called Ivan Vitkovich. Now, he doesn't know this, but Vitkovich is, in fact, a Polish Catholic who'd been sent off into exile by the Russians for writing anti-Russian messages on his blackboard in Poland in age 14. He's the only one of his school friends to survive the exile, where they've been put into hard labor on the steppe. And he's learnt Kazakh and all sorts of Persian and Arabic, exactly like Rawlinson had. And these two men meet each other brewing up tea in the borderlands of Persia and Afghanistan. And they both pretend not to be what they are. They're both playing around. I think they end up speaking in French to each other, but they try, Rawlinson tries Chagatay Turkish.
As you do.
As one does, Persian and everything else. And Rawlinson, Mikvich has all these like, and realizes, in the sense, who he's speaking to, although he doesn't know the name of the man. And anyway, Rawlinson then turns his horse around. He goes straight back to Tehran, although he's been on the road already for whatever it is, a week. And a camel messenger is sent off to the Gulf. Steamships cross to Egypt. The telegraph, which has got as far, I think, as Suez at this point, it taps out the first Morse code, which crosses to Downing Street. And some chap runs up the steps of the Foreign Office and says the Russians have gone into Afghanistan.
And so, Willie, tell us a bit about Afghanistan at this point. So this is a sort of borderland, right? I mean, there are local rulers, but it's a pretty wild place. Am I right?
It is a wild place, but it's actually not quite a borderland. At various points in its history, Afghanistan has been the center of many great empires. The Kushans, for example, ruled an empire which straddled most of the Stans, Afghanistan, and northern India. It's not true that Afghanistan has always been this sort of graveyard of empires. The Mughals had it as a very, very successful summer capital. When we think of Mughal summer capitals, we tend to think of Kashmir because it's within India and it's part of the same world. But in actual fact, Shah Jahan and Jahangir went as often to Kabul and played in the gardens there as they did to Kashmir. But the last great moment of Central Asian culture has been 200 years earlier, really, with Herat in the 16th century, which Robert Byron described as the Oriental Medici. You have some of the greatest miniature painters. You have some of the great universities of the Islamic world there. But the whole place has been losing its centrality as a center of culture for a while. There's a revival under a man called Ahmad Shah Durrani, who is one of the generals of Nadir Shah. And when Nadir Shah is assassinated, Ahmad Shah Durrani takes the Koh-i-Noor and basically uses it as the capital to found a new state, Afghanistan. And he creates an empire in the 1740s, which is only a century before the moment we're talking about, which gobbles up a chunk of Safavid Persia, a chunk of the Uzbek Empire, and a chunk of Mughal India, and creates for the first time an empire centered on Kabul, full of Afghans. And the English, although the word Afghanistan is never used, the Kingdom of Kabul is the political phrase. People do talk about for the first time Afghans. And so this is the beginning, in a sense, of the modern Afghan state, and its borders are more or less those of Afghanistan by default, because the Persians are where Persia is. Mughal India has now sort of ended in with the Sikh Empire and the Punjab, and the Uzbeks have steadied at the Oxus. So you have this space in between, which of course is the title of Rory Stewart's book, which becomes Afghanistan.
And so are they consciously playing, are they consciously playing off the Russians and the British? Because they're consciously these two empires either side.
And half the story of this, which again, has echoes today, is that the British fear of Russia creates the very nightmare that they fear. Because what happens is that following the sighting of Vitkovich by Rawlinson, this meeting in the desert, spies are sent off into Central Asia. One of these is Alexander Burns, who's also a great showman and a travel writer. And Alexander Burns has this wonderful moment when he travels up the Indus on a raft. And they have to have an excuse to get permission to go up the Indus. So what they know is that Ranjit Singh, the Sikh ruler of Lahore, loves horses. So they decide to present him with four enormous English cart horses. And then just to add to the whole thing, they decide they're going to take an old carriage that used to belong to the Lord Mayor of London. And they stuff it full of geographers from the Admiralty, who are busy taking soundings on the depth of the Indus and the flow charts and and all the rest of it. So this really quite professional spying expedition is heading up the Indus on a raft, being popped at shots being popped at it by local tribesmen, with Burns sitting beside the Lord Mayor of London's coach and four English dray horses, who have been rather out of place.
How has this not been made into a film?
A wonderful story. And Burns, to fast forward, not only presents a whole body of espionage material to his paymaster, because he is a spy, but he also, as his cover, is the great geographer, and he writes a three-volume account of his travels to Bukhara, which becomes a bestseller. He's received by Queen Victoria, who thinks he's very charming. He gets not only the Royal Medal of the Gold Medal of the Royal Geographical Society in London, but he also gets the its French equivalent. His book is translated into French, and of course, the Russians read it. And the Russians, who do not have spies in Bukhara at this point, then send Vitkovich to spy it out. And Vitkovich successfully rolls up Alexander Burns' espionage network that he set up in Bukhara. I mean, so it's actually no more than a couple of carpet dealers, but already everyone knows they're working for
the
British.
But basically, the key is don't write a book.
The key is
don't tell everyone what you're doing. I mean, it's mad.
Hope Rory Stewart is listening. Anyway, so the British managed to create a paranoia in the Russians. I mean, there is a very generalized fear the Russians definitely are moving south, but no, the Russians do not specifically have their eyes on Afghanistan. And certainly up to this point, other than a brief moment when, again, another wonderful raft story, there's the famous moment of Tilsit, when Alexander, the Tsar of Russia, and Napoleon meet on a barge and plan to invade India together in 1810. 1812 is the retreat. So is it 1809, 1812? War and Peace opens with Before Tilsit. That's book one of War and Peace. Today we always read it as War and Peace, but it's actually three volumes, Before Tilsit, book one. And the story goes, again, allegedly, but I don't know whether it's true, that there is a British spy under the raft.
I hope it's true.
Peter Hotkirk has this in his book. Other people have quibbled it, but I certainly want to believe it, whether it's true or not. And definitely there are plans that Napoleon hatched, very far-fetched and bonkers, to invade India. But that's the only time that Russia has actually thought of invading India, and that was alongside Napoleon in this brief moment of Russian-French union. And so, nonetheless, in London, particularly under somebody called Lord Ellenborough, who is the sort of, I don't know who the equivalent in politics is today, maybe Michael Gove on one of his more Islamist rants. He says, we are in great danger from the Russian bear. When the news comes that Vitkovich has crossed into Russia, Burns is sent on a mission to Kabul to try and pull Dost Mohammed into the British sphere.
So who's Dost Mohammed? Let me interrupt you.
Dost Mohammed is the man who has just overthrown Ahmad Shah Durrani's grandson, who is called Shah Shuja. Now, Shah Shuja goes off into exile in British India, where he's being kept in reserve as a British puppet that the British can put back if they want to. Dost Mohammed, his enemy, is now running Afghanistan.
And is it true, Willie, can I interrupt you? Is it true, I read, that Dost Mohammed had 16 wives, 27 sons and 25 daughters?
It certainly could be true, because he himself is definitely the 18th son of his father, Payne.
Wow, that's a big family gathering.
And as you can imagine, to get to be the ruling heir when you have 17 elder brothers.
You've got to be.
No uncertain ruthlessness. Anyway, Dost Mohammed actually has no ill feeling towards the British at all, or any particular fondness for the Russians. Burns says very clearly that there's absolutely no need to topple Dost Mohammed. We can pull him into our net and into our alliances very easily. But by this time, Burns is the most hated man in India, because all he has just come, got all the glory, met Queen Victoria, got the two gold medals, and all his superiors who've been working on the Afghan frontier absolutely hate him. They are green with jealousy at the success of this glamorous young man. And there's also quite a lot of stories that he's been sleeping with the women of Kabul and all this sort of stuff. So the two spy chiefs, Pottinger and Wade, do their best to rubbish everything that Burns is sending from Kabul. And in the end, a very bad decision that Dost Mohammed needs to be removed, he doesn't. And at this point, the East India Company doesn't even have a border with Afghanistan. They have to go through the Sikh Punjab. Ranjit Singh, the Lion of the Punjab, has an incredibly wonderful army trained up by ex-Napoleonic generals. He has fantastic cannon, which anyone who's in London can see, because they're now lined up on the lawns of Chelsea Hospital. If you go into Chelsea, you can see all these fantastic state-of-the-art Sikh cannon with all Ranjit Singh's insignia on them. And the army sets off. 20,000 men leave Firozpur in the Punjab. And with them are this fantastic camp followers. One general has 26 camels to carry his kit and a bath. There are five camels dedicated only to bringing the army's supply of cheroots. One camel carries nothing.
Five camels with cheroots. Is that cheroots possible?
And one camel is entirely carrying eau de cologne for the officers.
But makes you proud to be British.
Best of all, they've also, of course, brought their foxhounds.
Of course.
This ridiculous army marches off through the Punjab, which is perfectly possible because it's fertile and lovely, but then into the Baluchi desert in the middle of summer. They'd meant to leave in winter, and they've all left in winter outfits. But because Ranjit Singh has been frantically dragging his feet on giving them permission, to quite rightly, to cross the Punjab, because he knows that the minute they put the East India Company north and south of him, he's
toast.
So they end up crossing the Baluchi desert in the middle of high summer, with temperatures reaching 50 degrees, and they drop like flies. The half the foxhounds die. There are all sorts of stuff. Somehow, Lady Sale, who's with the army, manages to get her grand piano through. And I don't know how many camels have been employed by Lady Sale to get it up. But anyway, so this ridiculous. And yes, they have everything.
So why is Lady Sale going? Willie, why is Lady Sale going?
They have the eau de cologne, they have the shrews, but the one thing they don't have is a map.
Right.
Why is she going? Tom, that's a good question. Why does Lady Sale go, and why does she take... I mean, that's mad to take... That's just deluded to take a piano with you.
Well, you have to ask Lady Sale.
But she's going along just for the fun of it.
She takes the grand piano because she wants to play it.
Lady Sale is going for the fun of it, for the excitement of it.
No, she's married to Fighting Bob Sale, who is the...
Okay, right.
And so she's a military wife. So there's not, I mean, I think actually, in fairness, Lady Sale follows several months later. She's not actually on the advance guard.
Okay.
Nonetheless, she does bring a grand
piano. Okay. I suppose it's like taking an iPhone or something, isn't it?
Anyway, as I say, they have, you know, 260 camels of kit, 30 camels carrying cheroots, but they don't have a map, and they belatedly try and buy off the French Napoleonic general working for Ranjit Singh, one of the Napoleonic generals, sells them his sketch notes and sketch maps of Afghanistan that he's made on his journey from France. And the East India Company pays something colossal, like, I think, £25,000, which in 1842 is more or less like sort of £1 million for these sketch maps done on horseback by, you know, a guy without surveying equipment. And so they get very lost. And there's a lot of, you know, which way is Afghanistan? Go straight, go straight. massive death from sepoys who haven't been given any water, massive casualties. But against all likelihood, they arrive the other side of the desert and the other side of the mountains at Kandahar. And they take Kandahar the same night, although they haven't got artillery because they've left it behind. And the march from this point is exactly like the Taliban this week. Everyone just runs off and leaves. And they take Kabul without firing a shot. It's a direct parallel. And this happens over and over again in Afghanistan. The Afghans do not like to fight pitched battles. They're much too canny for that. They let you take their cities, and then it all begins with guerrilla activity. And this is exactly what happens. For one winter, the British do amateur theatricals in Kabul. They go duck shooting and ice skating. And
they play cricket, don't they? They play cricket.
They play cricket. There's lots of cricket. And there's lots of hunting of the foxhounds. Foxhounds who've survived the march are taken out to hunt jackals.
And presumably the piano comes in very useful over there.
In the meantime, the man put in charge of this, a guy called McNaughton, who is an Orientalist who goes, at one point, certainly, he's on the top of an elephant as he's entering Kabul, translating the Arabian Nights from Arabic as he arrives at his mission. And... And McNaughton, who has blue-tinted spectacles, also, like everybody else, hates Alexander Burns. So Burns got nothing to do. He's totally sidelined. He holds a Burns night. He is a cousin of Alexander Burns. He's a cousin of Robbie Burns, although his name is spelled slightly differently. There's reels and there's haggises in Kabul. But with nothing better to do, he gets back again and he starts seducing the wives of the Afghan warlords. And this, of course, is a very bad thing to do. If you are in Afghanistan, do not sleep with any warlord's wives. And this is literally what precipitates the rebellion. He takes the mistress of one of the tribal leaders called Abdullah Khan Achaksai. And according to one of the Afghan epic poems, which my friend Bruce Winnell translated to me about this, there's a passage where Abdullah Khan Achaksai summons his tribesmen and says, the English have ridden the donkey of their desires into the field of stupidity. This is possibly my favorite line in the whole book.
And so
we must all avoid riding the donkey of our desires into fields of stupidity.
Well, Willie, I think that's a perfect note on which to quickly take a break. And now, having ridden the donkey of stupidity into the field or whatever it is, we'll have a break. And when we come back, we will ride the donkey of stupidity even further to ultimate disaster.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
From Cleopatra to Camilla Parker Bowles, and from Madame de Pompadour to Lola Montez, the other woman has been a staple of gossip throughout history. But who will make our list of the top 10 mistresses of all time? Some of them are famed for their beauty, some for their political acumen, and some for their prowess in selling oranges. Glamour, sophistication, intelligence, savoir-faire. Join us for an evening rich in all these qualities and more. Dominic and myself will be at The Rest is History Live at the London Podcast Festival, Friday, September the 10th at 7 p.m. Tickets cost £12.50 and can be bought at kingsplace.co.uk. kingsplace.co.uk. See you there.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We have been riding the donkey of desire into the fields of stupidity. And what's going to happen next? I foresee disaster ahead. William Dalrymple, am I right?
You are exactly right, Dominic Thabrook. That is exactly what happened. So the Afghan tribes rise up, and quite a lot of the tribes had been very happy to support Shah Shuja, were pleased to see him back, but none of them like this British occupation force. And the East India Company army has behaved as it would have done in Bengal. They've laid out, first of all, their tents, then afterwards the tents are replaced by wooden and then a few brick structures or stone structures on the plains outside Kabul, as if it was the plains of Bengal. Apparently omitting to notice that every single one of these tents is overlooked by mountains immediately on top and perfect sniper territory. And they're too busy fox hunting and doing Scots reels and all the rest of it. So that when the uprising breaks out, very quickly the insurgents steal some East India Company cannon, pull it onto the hills around the camp and start bombarding it. And it's a completely indefensible position. And then, as chance would have it, because this uprising was not particularly planned, it was started by Abdullah Khan Achakzai because his girlfriend had run off to Alexander Burns's house. The first winter snows begin to fall, the passes block up, and there's clearly no help coming from Calcutta or from the Punjab.
Just a quick question about the army, Willie, that occurs to me. You describe them as East India Company cannon. So is this definitely an East India Company expedition rather than a British national expedition?
So when we were talking about the anarchy, and particularly battles like Plassey on the last time I came to the show, it's a very black and white thing because the company had 200,000 sepoys, which are the which were the force which invaded the whole of India. But in this case, there are now a mixture of regiments of the line, in other words, regular British army, fighting alongside East India Company sepoys. So the great mass of troops are East India Company sepoys, but I think there are at least two regiments of regular British army. Okay. Here. So it's a mix. So this is reflecting the position of the East India Company, by which the 1840s has become much more of a, what I suppose today we would call a public-private partnership. What started off as the ultimate libertarian trading company with no government links at all, other than a corporation, a charter to start it, has now become 50% owned by the British government. And by 1840, has actually been forbidden to, has lost its monopoly to trade. And so it's looking much more like a semi-governmental organization than the early days of Clive and Hastings.
Right.
The engineering thing. But still, you know, the fact remains, almost all the troops are Indian sepoys born in India. There's some Nepalis and some Gurkhas. And then there's a regiment of Skinner's Horse, for example, which is led by Anglo-Indians, the Skinner family. But there are several regiments of the line. And there's a snobbery of hierarchy. And the regiments of the line of British Army consider themselves in every way superior to the East India Company. The East India Company, however, speak Urdu and Hindi and feel that they're much superior to the British Army, who don't know what's going on locally. So there's lots of rivalry going on. And that is reflected in the response to the uprising, because the Elphinston, William Elphinston, who is the very dim cousin of the brilliant Mount Stuart Elphinston, who leads is a gouty veteran of Waterloo who hasn't seen action since 1815. We're now talking 1842, January. And his deputy, who's a man called Shelton, and he are on non-speaks. There's a massive divisions, and it's a complete fiasco. Not only are the company defeated in battle on the few occasions they do ride out and try and take on the insurgents in the hills around the country, they are running out of food. Lady Sale has now had to burn her grand piano for firewood because they run out of heating material. They've eaten the foxhounds by the stage.
Oh, that's very bad form.
But the cricket bats are all right. Please tell me the cricket bats are okay.
I think the cricket bats, I suspect, would also have been burnt. I know
things are getting bad.
Primary source evidence for that. Anyway, there's obviously no option but to retreat. And it's now January 1842. And the Afghans seem to be dragging their feet a little during negotiations. And people are mystified by this because they think, you know, they probably want to get rid of us as much as we want to get out of here. And it drags on for two or three weeks. Finally, the moment comes in January when they set off into the snow. And everyone knows this is not looking good. The passes are anyway almost entirely blocked. No one moves armies around Central Asia in the middle of winter because you can, you know, freeze in seconds outside your tent. And what, of course, has happened is the Afghans prepared a whole series of barricades and ambushes, and they're just waiting for them. And within a few hours of setting off from the cantonment, not only have attacks begun on the column, but the cantonment has been burnt down and looted, rather like some of the scenes seen in Kabul this weekend of looting. The people run. Oh no! Exactly what happened to Bamiyan when it was deserted a month ago. Exactly what happened at Bagram Air Base when the Americans left it 2 months ago. The locals just ran in and looted it. Is exactly what happens in the British cantonment in January 1842. So the first night, the British are stuck in the snow, having snipers firing at them, and they can see behind them the flames of the cantonment, the light, the cantonment flickering fires. And they know there's no retreat. They can't go back. But it's 5 days' march to Jalalabad.
And Willie, what I remember from Flashman is that Elphinstone gets shot in the buttocks, doesn't he?
Well, that's so much with Flashman. There's an awful lot which is historically accurate, but a certain amount of license.
Right, okay. So that didn't happen. That's terrible. The one fact I remember isn't true.
Elphinstone is definitely wounded, but in the sources I've read, buttocks are not.
Okay.
But yes, Elfie Bey, as he's called, is wounded, has a stroke, I think, probably in the middle of all this horror. And day by day, the number of survivors goes down from 20,000 to 10,000 to 5,000 to 2,000. There's a terrible moment at a place called Jigdalik, where the holly hedge is erected in their path. And the cavalry, which so far have been marching out fairly easily, can't get over this. And they're shot down and people are crawling over it. Several hundred die on this hedge, unable to cross this barrier that's erected in their way. And finally, there's a bunch of lancers making the last stretch, and the 51st Foot, who form themselves into a square on the hill of Gundamuk, fight until their ammunition is exhausted, and then form a bayonet line.
There's a very famous painting of this, isn't there, Willie?
Famous painting, exactly. They fight until their last bullet. They form a bayonet wall, but the Afghans realize there's no need to charge bayonets. They just pull back. And one of the features of the war is that the Afghans have this very old-fashioned Mughal jazail, which is a hunting rifle that Shah Jahan could be seen using to hunt deer. And it's a big, heavy, unwieldy thing, but it has a very long barrel and is accurate over a distance of about half a mile, while the Brown Bess musket fires only 300 yards. So they realize there's no need to take these guys on shoulder to shoulder. They just pull back and shoot from a distance, and every last man is killed, except for one guy who has wrapped himself in the colors, and he's taken hostage because they think he must be worth something because he's got such fancy colored clothes on. That is a guy called Thomas Souter, and the first British camp in Helmand was called Camp Souter after his memory. Anyway, this leaves some lancers who are cut down one by one by the last of the cavalry until only Dr. Brydon is left on his nag. And the reason Dr. Brydon survives is he has a copy of Blackwood's magazine. He's a reader. He would definitely have subscribed to The Rest Is History if he was around today. And he has a copy of Blackwood's magazine in his forage cap, so that when these two Afghan horsemen come for him, one of them shoots a pistol which misfires, and then he hacks at him with a sword, but it goes into Blackwood's magazine, which is sitting in his hat because he presumably wanted to read in the evening, and doesn't pierce his skull, and he alone of the British troops makes it through to Jalalabad. In the days
did Blackwoods use that as a kind of advertising slogan?
Should have done.
Read Blackwoods, it'll keep you alive. It's the kind of thing the TLS would do, or London Review of Books or something.
Contrary to the myth, he's not the only survivor. He's not even the only white survivor. Several other troops straggle in after him. Bizarrely, a Greek shopkeeper who'd been running this sort of kebab shop at the cantonment has hidden in a cave and comes in with a bottle of ouzo a week later. There's a whole bunch of Nepali Gurkhas who have just gone up some valleys and are completely happy with the temperature and completely used to surviving. And so the Gurkhas sort of reappear about a week later in perfect order with their metal shining and all the rest of it. And then some of the Hindu sepoys turn up a year and a half later at the Kumbh in Hardwar, having walked all the way home. So he's not, in fact, the only survivor. Okay,
So Lady Sale.
Lady Sale, along with all the other lady, or several of the other ladies, not all of them, by any, many are killed. But Lady Sale, along with several others, are taken hostage. And then there's protracted hostage negotiations. And basically, at the end of the day, there's a swap. Dost Muhammad, who had been captured, or rather given himself up earlier, had been kept in the British hill station of Mussoorie, in the Himalayas. Dost Muhammad is brought back. And the man negotiating is Dost Muhammad's son, Akbar Khan, who is a young, handsome, sort of movie hero type, who's led this resistance and planned the holly hedge at Jagdalik and all the rest of it. And Dost Muhammad is brought home. He makes an agreement with the British that he will not allow the Russians in, and otherwise he's allowed to come back unmolested. And you end up at the end, and Lady Sale and the others are swapped for him.
And they haven't been molested.
Have they been looked after well, or have they
fared in captivity?
Kept very well, including my direct forebear, Colin McKenzie, who's dressed up in Afghan dress, making a great sort of... he has lots of self-portraits painted when he gets home in Afghan dress, all this sort of stuff. The war ends exactly as this war has ended, with the government, which was in power before all this, coming back into power. And because no one can threaten it anymore, because of the enormous prestige it's won defeating an imperial power, Dost Muhammad then stays in power for the rest of his life. And he has a very grand tomb, which I've seen in the Ghazagar in Herat, one of the most beautiful Sufi shrines in Afghanistan.
And Willie, what about Shah Shuja?
So Shah Shuja, who is the hero of my book, Return of a King, the king in question is Shah Shuja. Shah Shuja is a very attractive character. He is a poet. He keeps his nerve when the uprising breaks out in Kabul. And when the British flee and desert him, he's holed up in the Bala Hissar, having defended it very admirably. He's an extremely brave man. He's persistent. His flaw is he's too grand. He doesn't. He makes everybody stand in his durbars, which was the Mughal style, and his mother is Mughal, but is not the manner or the Afghans used to. They're used to sitting down on a carpet altogether in a tribal jirga. And this egalitarian mode is what makes Dost Muhammad so successful. He doesn't play grand. He entertains and charms all his tribesmen. And this is one of the many parallels, if we can move on to parallels, with the present, because...
But before that, what happens to Shah Shuja?
Shah Shuja survives all this. The British cut up, deals are done, and Shah Shuja, in the end, is killed by a godson who wants to get in with Dost Muhammad. But for that, he may well have survived the whole thing. But he has slighted a godson who feels he hasn't been given promotion or something. And so some small, petty internal feud does.
So it's rudeness that does it. And sorry, I interrupted you when you were talking about the parallels, because that is a great parallel, isn't it?
Because there is a huge premium in Afghanistan still on basic politeness. And this was one of the great qualities of Hamid Karzai, who would make every Afghan, particularly any tribal elder who'd come in from the countryside, he would give them time, he would talk to them, he would.
So he was the first president of...
He was the first president that the
Americans... Stalled in what, 2002, yeah.
In 2002. But the important point, as far as, again, this war is concerned, that we're talking about, is he is the direct descendant of Shah Shuja. He is the head of the Putuzai tribe. We basically put the same guy in twice. Karzai is a slightly nicer version of Shah Shuja. Karzai did actually an incredible job charming everyone. And his replacement, Ashraf Ghani, who incidentally is a good friend, was very kind to me, the man that helped me find a lot of the sources for the book when he was head of the history department and chancellor of Kabul University. Ashraf was incredibly rude to people. He was very grand. He had worked for the World Bank, taught at Columbia. He didn't have time for fools. He was a very successful university professor and World Bank technocrat. but would give tribal leaders who'd walked 20 days across Afghanistan to see him 10 minutes. He'd literally say, you've got 10 minutes. Another story I've heard, which is interesting, is that he also put his feet up in front of tribal elders. Now, in India still today, I've always been taught that you must never point your feet at someone. If you're sitting cross-legged, it's hugely rude in that culture to point your feet or to put your feet up. Ashraf Ghani had a sort of puff in front of his armchair, and he just put his feet up like you would at home. But this went down apparently very badly and seriously offended a whole series of tribal elders who invited him to his inner sanctum. And Karzai never did this. And weird story with this is that Karzai read my book, Return of a King, and he had always been haunted by the fact that Shah Shuja was his forebear and that Shah Shuja had died regarded as a traitor by many of the Afghans. And he was particularly worried because the tribe which brought down Shah Shuja, the tribesmen of the man whose mistress Alexander Burns seduced, Abdullah Khan Achakzai, were the Gilzai tribe. And the Gilzai, remarkably today, are the foot soldiers of the Taliban. And so beneath what we perceive very easily today as a simple battle of Democrats and westernized Afghans against Islamist tribal barbarians actually masks a old tribal fault line, which is the Barakzais and Popalzais, who are the toffs, the landowners, against the Gilzai, who are the herdsmen and the day laborers on the Popalzais lands. And Mullah Omar is a descendant of the resistance leader of 1842.
Willie, the implication of all that, that would, for some listeners, they will say that creates a sense of inevitability, that the patterns of history are merely repeating themselves. Is that too simplistic, though? Do you think there is a kind of truth?
In this
to that?
Case, we did literally put the same guy on the throne twice. We put the head of the Popalzai tribe, and he was brought down by the Gilzai. It was that simple. And let's say the weird story that follows is that Karzai read Return of a King very closely. He was given it by someone as he was on his way to Washington to meet Obama. And none of us knew any about this until WikiLeaks, because it turned out that Hillary Clinton was very upset because when he came out of the place, having read this book, he altered his policy and began to be publicly much more hostile to the Americans while taking their help, while taking their military. He saw it as vital that he didn't look like Shah Shuja and appear to be the puppet of the Americans. And so publicly he started making very rude remarks about Americans, creating casualties by inadequate intelligence, bombing the wrong villages, and all this sort of stuff. And he was very frosty to Obama. And WikiLeaks revealed these letters from Hillary Clinton, emails from Hillary Clinton, which were, we now know, taken by the Russians and handed to WikiLeaks. What is this bloody book that Karzai is reading? Ever since he's picked it up, he's become completely intransigent and won't talk to us and is incredibly rude. And this was all when WikiLeaks came out, this was all on the front page of the New York Times. And at this point, I then got invited to brief the White book got more and more absurd. But the best bit was when Karzai then called me to one Ramadan to his palace, now occupied by the Taliban. I saw a picture on the internet this morning of the Taliban flag flying over the Arg, the old citadel in the center of Kabul. But we basically did a deal. And Karzai said, if you come to me during Ramadan, which is the kind of, the big fasting and the holiday in the Islamic world, come to me during Ramadan, and we will talk every evening after iftar, after the breaking the fast. We will have fruit together, and I will ask you about Shah Shuja, and in return, you can have an interview. So I got 6 hours of interview with Karzai, which went into a New York Times profile, which is online if anyone wants to read it. And in return, Karzai got to ask all the questions about Shah Shuja from these sources, which Ashraf Ghani had given me. So it's all... It's a rare case of a history book, in a small way, genuinely altering the course of policy today. In the end, of course, it didn't make any difference because, as we now know, the wider lineaments of history repeating overtook all this, and we now are back exactly where we were at the end of the 1842 First Anglo-Afghan War with the same ruler in charge.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Isn't it, Willie? Do you think, looking back now after 20 years, I mean, I know this is a massive question and we're reaching the end of the podcast anyway, but do you think the Taliban's victory was inevitable?
No, I don't think it was inevitable. I think Karzai showed that with the right politeness and kindness, and by distancing himself from his Western host, he could mask the fact that he was kept in power by a Western puppet master and make a regime which was acceptable to the Afghans. But it was touch and go. And when someone less dexterous, Ashraf Ghani, took over and was rude to people and diminished the popularity of the regime and alienated one by one tribal leaders from across the country. Ashraf actually, you know, had a temper. He used to throw things at people. I heard a story, for example, one press conference where he threw an ashtray at a female journalist. That sort of thing just doesn't play.
Because really, the general sense that historians have is the interplay of great tectonic plates grinding against each other, vast impersonal forces. But in 1842, it's Byrne seducing the wrong woman.
Correct.
And you're saying that now it's a guy throwing ashtrays at people.
I think we know in our own...
Are those tiny kind of trigger points that affect...
I think from our own experience in our own time, there are tiny things that these great forces of history, these great Tolstoyan moments, these great Tolstoyan forces which form the economy and shape the destiny of nations do exist. But equally, tiny little accidents can alter things. For example, in our own time, if Boris Johnson had, you know, he famously wrote the two articles pro Brexit and against Brexit. If he had actually decided to back Cameron and not taken the path of going for Brexit, would we be where we are now with Europe? Quite possibly not. One man's decision at a crucial moment can alter things.
In the context of Afghanistan, though, you say that this is a society where politeness is very important and knowing the rules of courtesy are very important. Do you think it's a problem, and you know, for the West right the way from the 1840s, that we tend not to know these rules?
It certainly is a problem. As I said, there are a huge array of possibilities every day in all our lives. You know, if we were to turn right rather than to turn left at a given moment, how history would be different. But yes, I think I don't think it was impossible that a pro-Western regime could have survived in Afghanistan, because the Taliban were very unpopular. They were an extremely brutal regime. This regime now, though, is regarded as incredibly corrupt. And it's rather like the Islamic revolution in Iran in the 70s. There is a huge number of people who feel that a small elite have gobbled up corruptly huge sums of money. There are stories circulating in Kabul now that Ashraf Ghani's car was stuffed with cash. And they couldn't get it all in the plane he escaped in, and a lot of the money was left on the runway in Kabul. Three or four people have told me the story. I have no idea whether it's true or not. But the fact that enough people believe these stories creates an atmosphere where the regime that has just ended was seen to be corrupt, greedy. Ghani's nephew left in a Learjet with an Instagram post saying, trying to leave as bad as I can. That sort of thing creates massive upset with poor people who have not got their hands in the money pot, who are not eating the honey. I think many people will be waiting to see whether this regime is better for them. Many women will have their lives destroyed. There will be huge cruelty. There will be terrible. I personally think it's a catastrophe. And I have many, many friends whose lives have been hobbled and restricted and whose lives may well be in danger. I got an email from Karzai's office this morning saying he's okay and that he's it read rather like, in fact, a kind of carry on up the Khyber email saying there was some moments of tension but all is now restored.
Right, well, hope for the best. What a somber note in which to end.
Incredible sang-froid. But you know, many people's lives will be deeply damaged by this. Whether this regime manages to solidify itself and hold together like Dost Muhammad managed after the catastrophe of 1842 when he came back into power, remains to be seen. Already, certainly, the Taliban have proved to be far more disciplined and less fractured than we all thought they were. The idea was that this was a bunch of disparate hooligans and fundamentalists in the hills, incapable really of cohering and mounting a coordinated campaign. But that was clearly very wrong. It's been an extraordinary military success.
So a bit like the way that the various tribes in 1842 got together to absolutely seal the doom of the British retreat.
Although again, you know, there were all sorts of tensions and tribal rivalries within the resistance that the British,
but they held together. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's an incredibly somber note on which to end. And again, absolute tour de force of historical explication.
Yeah. So, thank you, Willie. Thank you. You Willie. Retain your record. Yeah. You definitely retain your record.
Could I, there's just one thing, one other note on which I'd like to end, which is, it's not to do with Afghanistan, but it is to do with Iraq, where Western forces also intervened and left a kind of a lot of damage. And it's a walk that I'm doing on the 23rd and 24th. So that's next Monday, if you're listening to this as it comes out. And next Tuesday, walking 50 miles in 24 hours. And that is partly in aid of Yazidi refugees, religious minority in Iraq, who still can't go back to their homes, who are suffering terribly intense. So any sponsorship you could give me on that would be hugely appreciated. And you can get the link on it's my pinned tweet at Holland_Tom. So many thanks for that. Thank you, Willie, for allowing me to do that. Thank you, Dominic.
Another appeal at this point, Rory Stewart's Turquoise Mountain Foundation has issued an appeal for Afghans who are in difficulty at the moment in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Rory Stewart's Twitter site is easy to find. There aren't any other Rory Stewart's, and the details at his pinned tweet at the top of his thing. But a very, very worthy cause.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Willie. That was absolutely fascinating. So that ends our Afghan duo, and we will see you all next week for more. The rest is history. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.